of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, November 30th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
What's expected in Cancun for the UN climate talks? The significance of the latest WikiLeaks documents release? And California cities look to water privatization to ease budgets? A new report adds up the true cost. Plus, this week's edition of People's Marketplace.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The United Nations-sponsored Conference on Climate Change began in Cancun, Mexico on Monday. Nearly 200 countries will be negotiating over 2 weeks in the first global meetup since the Copenhagen Conference in December 2009. The much-anticipated Copenhagen summit had begun with high expectations but ended with a non-binding agreement that was largely derided. There was major disagreement between first-world governments and the leadership of developing economies. Developing nations argued that their wealthier counterparts were dodging tough reforms. China balked at U.S. demands to submit to third-party inspections processes of its carbon reduction efforts. The U.S., and specifically the U.S. Senate, has been criticized in the year since Copenhagen for failing to pass comprehensive climate change legislation at home. Without domestic consensus on climate goals and action, the U.S. has not been willing to commit to international goals. Expectations going into the Cancun talks are significantly lower than a year ago. However, some are calling this shift in favor of pragmatism, not fatalism. Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Climate Change, said Cancun will be a success if small but significant steps are taken toward the eventual goal of a binding international treaty. Eileen Clausen joins me on the phone now. Welcome to Uprising.
My pleasure to be there.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how do you sum up the results of what happened in Copenhagen last year? Did anything come out of it that was significant?
Yes, I actually think something did come out of it. And part of the problem is that we had great expectations going in that we would have a binding treaty emerge from it. And, of course, that didn't happen. But, you know, quite honestly, those expectations were very unrealistic to begin with. So what did happen was that at a scramble at the end, something emerged called the Copenhagen Accord, which was not accepted by everyone, but which essentially laid out some commitments from all the major developing countries to start reducing emissions. Now, I should say that this isn't what we need to really address the problem, but it is the first time that we've had some commitments on the table. And while I also recognize that it's voluntary, not mandatory, and, you know, there's some chance that people won't do what they have pledged to do, it is a step. And really, we're looking for steps at this point, not for everything to come together, because it won't.
So in Cancun, with the United States coming in without any kind of legislation, domestic legislation, and with the United States essentially being the worst polluter per capita, well, not even per capita, I should say, but at least in general, one of the worst polluters in the developed world, how much hope is there in Cancun?
Well, I think you aren't going to get a binding treaty emerge from Cancun, and at this point, no one expects that either. Part of the reason is the United States. I mean, we were not able to pass legislation last year. We do have some tools to reduce emissions, but they're not going to get you very close to the pledge that was made in Copenhagen, which was 17% below 2005 levels. And we also will probably have a problem with funding, because part of what emerged from Cancun was a pledge to provide fast start money on the order of $30 billion, and also to amass a fund that would help developing countries move forward on this. And we're in a difficult budget situation, so not only do we not have legislation, but we also are not going to be able to make good on serious money pledges. But I should add here that we are not the only problem. part of, I think, what would be necessary would be for China, who is certainly not the largest per capita emitter, but is the largest total emitter at the moment, and with emissions growing at a very rapid rate, seems unwilling to either move forward on transparency, in other words, letting people know with data whether they are doing what they have said they will do, nor are they willing to move toward any kind of binding commitment, regardless of what the target might be for themselves. So really, if you don't have the U.S. and China, who are the two largest emitters, ready to move to a binding treaty, there's no way that you're going to get there. My own take is that we should try to build some of the pieces here. We should move forward as far as we can on transparency. We should move forward to do the architecture of the fund. We should move forward on forestry issues, where I think there is some consensus on the development of technology centers around the world that can help countries move forward with new, cleaner technology. So I think there are a number of things that can get done in Cancun, all of which will be necessary for a binding treaty eventually. If we're able to do that, I think we will at least rebuild some confidence in the system that we have.
Now, on the issue of financing, didn't the United Nations gather a committee this year in the year since Copenhagen to try to come up with ways in which developed nations could help finance the adaptation to climate change for poor countries?
Yes, they did. And unfortunately, I don't see, particularly with the economic situation the way it is globally, how we're going to move forward in as robust a way as we need to come up with the dollars that actually will be necessary. And you're raising the issue of adaptation actually is really mm-hmm. important, because no matter how much we are able to reduce emissions, and the picture there is not as good as it should be, but even if we were to do everything there, we have bought quite a bit of climate change already with the emissions we've put up into the atmosphere, and we will have to adapt. And wealthier countries can find ways to finance some of that, although it's going to be very expensive. But poorer countries simply don't have either the capacity or the money to do it. And coming up with serious money to help, I think, is important, and it's a moral obligation as well.
Now, who are some of the leaders among developing nations outside of China? I'm thinking of Brazil and India, who have taken leadership roles in international conferences in the past. Brazil, in particular, being the steward of one of the most important carbon sinks in the world. Is it playing a leadership role in the right direction?
Yes and no. A group of countries, and they call themselves the basic countries, it's Brazil, mm-hmm. South Africa, India, and China, actually have sort of established themselves as a small group, and they meet and talk about how to move forward on this issue. I would say that Brazil has done some things in a very constructive way, but when it comes to things like the Amazon rainforest, I think they are very protective of it. And have a very strong sense of it is theirs. So while they are doing quite a bit on the clean energy side, and they're being quite constructive in the talks, they also have this sort of dual role and identity, because they want to do things in the Amazon. I mean, they are now sort of moving forward to try to protect a lot of it, but they don't want other governments to interfere and tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. India has made some strides. I think the Indian Environment Minister has been very constructive and has made a lot of comments about how we need a good package of things to come out of Cancun. So they have been constructive. South Africa has been very constructive. And, of course, they're going to be hosting the meeting the year after Cancun, and want very much to make sure that some progress is made in Cancun and then perhaps more could be made in South Africa. So I think you do see some leadership from that group. But there are other countries as well, and you know, some of them are difficult. So, you know, getting 180 or more countries to agree on things is a huge challenge.
My guest is Eileen Clausen. She's the president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, and we're talking about the Cancun Climate Talks, the UN-sponsored conference that followed from the conference that happened last year in Copenhagen. Country representatives are gathering starting yesterday, in fact, and it's going on for 2 weeks. So what exactly is expected over the 2 weeks? What is the anatomy of the conference, if you will? Are there country representatives meeting in smaller groups first and then trying to build consensus, or has everything sort of been pre-planned?
No, I wouldn't go so far as to say everything is pre-planned. I mean, all of these conferences have some combination of small group meetings to try to reach some agreements, followed by some reaching out to others, followed by large plenary sessions where all countries sit around and have a microphone. And where you try to get a consensus decision. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. And you saw some combination of all of these things at all the preparatory meetings over the course of this year, too, the last of which was in China. So that's the way this conference works. And then there are, you know, numerous press conferences by different countries expressing particular points of view. There are lots of side events, usually co-sponsored by NGOs, on different aspects of the conference where you actually can learn a lot, because different groups have done different kinds of research and analysis and have important contributions to make. So you also have that going on at the same time. You have a lot of industry people there, both industries who are interested in clean technology futures, industries who are worried that something might emerge which would not be in their interests. And they do a certain amount of lobbying and listening as well. So it's a huge get-together of a lot of people who are involved in climate change, both internationally in terms of negotiations, but also nationally at home, where they're trying to push different kinds of policies.
Now, is there also a conversation, you think, happening or will be happening in Cancun around simply sticking with the original climate treaty, the Kyoto Protocol?
Yes, that's the other thing that is really on the table. The budget period, I mean, Kyoto itself does not expire, but the budget period in which many countries, but not the United States, accepted binding emission reduction targets, the period ends in 2012, and there is a huge question about what happens to the countries that are part of the Kyoto Protocol after 2012. Do they have another budget period with another set of reductions or not? And I don't think that it actually will get resolved in Cancun. I mean, there are very strong differences of opinion there. There are some countries with Kyoto targets, like the European Union, who are perfectly willing to take another binding target for another period beyond 2012. But there are other countries, like Japan in particular, but I think also Australia, who really think that we need binding commitments for all the major emitting countries, including the United States, not a party to Kyoto, and China, which had no binding target of any kind under Kyoto. So because of this divide, I actually see this issue sort of being pushed off a little bit. I mean, I think it will be a focus, but I don't think people will come together. And so we have that track moving forward, moving forward a little bit, but not really going anywhere. And then you've got the broader track where everyone participates under the convention, including the United States, where all we have actually is the Copenhagen Accord with these non-binding targets, but targets from many, many, many countries, including developing countries.
I want to spend the last few minutes of our conversation talking about the United States and what has been happening here domestically with the change in the political landscape after the midterm elections. The likelihood of the U.S. actually taking some constructive, positive action on climate change legislation is even less than when there was a Democratic majority controlling Congress. What do you think the role that the results of the midterm elections will play in the U.S. on the domestic front?
Well, I mean, we are in a very difficult political situation. I think the chances of anything constructive in terms of climate change legislation in the next 2 years are virtually zero. What we do have are some administrative authorities under different departments of government and different pieces of legislation. EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. It also has the authority under the Clean Air Act as well to regulate traditional pollutants. And the result of some of that, I think, will be that we shut down some of the oldest, dirtiest coal plants, which will be helpful in terms of emissions. You also have some market trends in the United States where I think we're going to see more natural gas power plants rather than coal-based power plants. And natural gas, while not the answer, does end up by emitting far less greenhouse gases. Mm. So I actually think U.S. emissions are not going to go up. They're probably going to stay stable or go down, even in the absence of legislation.
So just through these sort of regulatory mechanisms outside legislation?
Yes. I mean, I think that's where it is. And don't forget, there will be efforts in the Congress to take away EPA's authorities here, particularly in terms of climate change legislation. So that's a fight that I think will be had. And how the president responds and whether he signs that or not, I think, is a question.
Well, Eileen Clausen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Would you like to give out a website on the Pew Center?
Yes, I would. We try to keep up to date on all of these things, political and substantive. It's www.pewclimate.org.
That's pewclimate.org, P-E-W, climate.org. Eileen Clausen, thanks.
Thank you.
Eileen Clausen is the president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Again, that website she recommended, pewclimate.org. We linked it from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today as well. And if you're signed up to our mailing list, it'll arrive in your inbox. We've been talking about the Cancun Climate Conference, sponsored by the United Nations, that just began yesterday, and it's going to go on for another couple of weeks. This is Uprising, and after the short break, we'll analyze the latest release by WikiLeaks with Phyllis Bennis, who's going to be my guest. We'll also hear this week's edition of The People's Marketplace with Martina Steiner. And finally, we'll look at how some cities in California are looking at privatizing their water supplies in order to ease their budgets. A new report points out the true cost of water privatization. Stay tuned.
On Saturday, December 11th, the Afghan Women's Mission will hold its fifth annual Fair Trade and Conscious Gifts Holiday Bazaar in the Geneva Room of the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Browse through a large selection of affordable, sweatshop-free, unique arts and crafts made by artisans internationally and locally, including Fair Trade embroidered pillow covers, wallets and purses from Afghanistan, Fair Trade Palestinian olive oil and spices, vintage political posters, jewelry, mirrors, soaps, candles, oils, and much more. And KPFK, in lieu of our annual parking sale, will be selling new books and music. There will be complimentary coffee, tea, and refreshments. That's the fifth annual Fair Trade and Conscious Gifts Holiday Bazaar on Saturday, December 11th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, located at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. Call 626-676-7884 for more information or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. In its third major release of classified information this year, the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks.org released over 250,000 classified State Department diplomatic cables, most of them from the years 2006 to 2009. A small number of news organizations, including the New York Times and the Guardian of London, were given early access to analyze and publish the communiques from American diplomats stationed around the world. Among the treasure trove of material that has embarrassed the U.S. is the revelation that American diplomats stationed overseas are now routinely expected to spy on government officials and heads of states of countries where they are stationed, as well as the United Nations. The spying includes gathering personal and banking details, as well as biometric data like fingerprints and DNA. The secret memos also reveal private communications by foreign government officials about third countries. For example, the Saudi king has been revealed to be urging the U.S. to take military action against Iran's nuclear program. The Obama administration's reaction has been predictable, aggressively condemning the release of the memos while warning that innocent lives are being endangered. Australia, where WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is a citizen, is collaborating with the U.S. government in attempting to bring criminal charges against Assange under the Espionage Act. This latest release of 251,000 diplomatic cables are thought to have originated from the same source as the Iraq and Afghan war logs released earlier this year. The documents are assumed to have been downloaded from the Pentagon's internal computer network, SIPRNet, which stands for the Secret Internet Protocol Router Network, which more than 2.5 million people have access to. Before we turn to our live guest, I want to play the voices of the Guardian newspaper reporters who worked on analyzing the latest WikiLeaks document release. Here's their take on the significance of the diplomatic cables.
It's a bombshell. It's a historian's dream. It's a diplomat's nightmare. Because you see how the State Department works at the middle level. I mean, it doesn't have the most sensitive stuff, but it's still the most extraordinary window into how American diplomacy works.
At one level, as a former diplomat and a government employee, it's fascinating to be able to read someone else's telegrams, to read especially those called no foreign. No foreign means no foreign distribution, so no foreigner is supposed to see them. So it was interesting to see actually what good analysis the American diplomats had, how well informed they were, how well connected they were, and how much they knew about political situations.
We've seen big information releases like this previously, but what really strikes me about this information is that it is giving an idea of what's happening all around the world, not just from one country, but this is how the American government is operating in a number of countries.
What you've got in these cables is material that ranges from reports of really worldwide significance, for example, on the dangers of Pakistan developing nuclear weapons, very important sensitive issues, all the way down to what you might call diplomatic tittle-tattle, such as personality profiles of world leaders and a few disobliging remarks that are going to ruffle a few feathers.
I think anybody who's had what they thought of as a private conversation with an American diplomat over the last 5 or 10 years would be astonished to think that that information had been shared with 3 million others, so that young corporals in their 20s in Baghdad were able to access this stuff and read it and, as we now know, copy it.
The thing about digitization is it means that you don't have to take huge truckloads of paper out of a government body. It's really as simple as putting it on a data stick or a hard drive. Increasingly, information is a commodity, and where governments use information for power, it is much harder for them to monopolize that power because it can be dispersed so readily and rapidly. I think what governments need to do is change their relationship to citizens. They need to stop thinking that if knowledge is power, only they are able to access it, and they sort of dribble it out as fits their needs. They need to sort of look at the citizen more as a partner, more as an equal, and really think about, does all this information need to be classified? And I would say a lot of these documents, it doesn't.
It's the kind of thing that's never been leaked before, and it's liable to cause a worldwide diplomatic crisis for the United States. And not only for the United States, but for many of the countries which contain harsh judgments or disclosures that we see in these cables. So I think there are going to be shockwaves around the world.
And those are some of the voices of the Guardian newspaper reporters who worked on analyzing the latest WikiLeaks document release. Joining me now on the phone is my guest, Phyllis Bennis. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she's the author of a number of books, including Ending the War in Afghanistan, a primer. Welcome to Uprising, Phyllis Bennis.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, only 281 cables have actually been released to the public so far. And by the way, for listeners, you can find them online at cablegate.wikileaks.org. Phyllis, let's talk about the issue of spying first. Do you get the sense from the news coverage so far that the Obama administration initiated this bizarre level of diplomatic spying, or did it start before him?
This goes back to several generations, really, of diplomacy. If we look, for example, at the spying at the UN, which included some rather shocking developments that are very much 21st century products, Hillary Clinton, for instance, signed off on a specific demand to her diplomats asking for
forensic technical details, communication systems used by top UN officials that would include passwords, personal encryption keys, private email access, as well as biometric info. I mean, this was the rather shocking part. It's like they're going after Ban Ki-moon's toothbrush. You know, they want DNA material. They want iris scans, fingerprints. This is very new. But the concept of going after the UN and other diplomats is a very old one. It goes back to the very origins of the United Nations, where the U.S. Secretly wiretapped in what was then quite primitive by our standards, wiretapping means the hotel rooms and even the train carriages of the top diplomats heading to San Francisco for the conference to create the United Nations. And it's gone on ever since. Back in 2003, there was a scandal involving the expose in the Observer newspaper in London about a memo from the National Security Agency that asked British diplomats, as well as others, to carry out surveillance at the UN on the ambassadors and other staff representing what had become known as the Uncommitted Six, the six members of the Security Council that were refusing to vote for an endorsement of the then-looming U.S. war in Iraq. And they were targeting diplomats at the UN. About a year later, there was another expose. This is all under the Bush administration, of course. There was another expose that involved the U.S. actually wiretapping top diplomats and premises of the United Nations itself. So this is nothing new, but what it does show is that there's no change in the Obama administration's approach, that despite the promises of President Obama that he would carry out a new kind of engagement with the world, what we're seeing is a very long-standing, old-fashioned kind of engagement without taking seriously, or at least without any visible seriousness, to a commitment for a new kind of foreign policy.
Let's talk about some of the things that have been revealed in these diplomatic cables. Iran has garnered a lot of attention. What do you make of the memos that reveal Iran may indeed have nuclear weapons with high enough range to target Western Europe?
No, there's nothing about having nuclear weapons. The claim is that there are missiles that could reach further. And
right.
There's a way in which the memos are drawn in such a way that it kind of deliberately implies that these are somehow nuclear missiles. These are not nuclear missiles. These are missiles, which is not good. It's not good that anybody in that region or any region, including here in the United States, has those kinds of long-term missiles, long-range missiles. But that's separate from the nuclear stuff. I think that there's a lot of cherry-picking going on. Some of this was cherry-picking by WikiLeaks, as far as we can tell. Some of it was cherry-picking by the three main newspapers who had the documents early. And some of it, of course, has been the cherry-picking of analysts looking at what's been published so far and drawing conclusions from it, including conclusions that this whole document drop is all about Iran, that the whole purpose of this and the whole effect of it is to provide new evidence that Iran is indeed a threat, that even Arab leaders are calling for military strikes against Iran. And I think that's really an exaggeration. Certainly there are examples in here. There are cables that deal directly with Iran that go particularly to this question of Arab leaders being far more candid with their U.S. interlocutors, as reported by whoever these note-takers were, than they are in public. What that speaks to, I mean, it's of course nothing new. We've known all along that key Arab leaders supported by the United States, who buy their arms from the United States, provide oil to the United States, and depend on the United States for strategic backing, have always been willing to embrace a kind of anti-Iran position. That's not new. What it does show here is the depth of the divide between these leaders and their own populations, who are uniformly massively opposed to not only military strikes against Iran, but who overwhelmingly do not see Iran as the regional danger. There were also specific cables in this batch that we're not hearing as much about in the coverage of the Iran stuff. So, for example, there's a 2007 cable noting a statement by the Mossad chief, then Mossad chief, the Israeli version of the CIA, whose name was Meir Dagan. And he was speaking to a U.S. diplomat at the time, a guy named Nicholas Barnes, and he told Barnes that it was sort of a promise that Israel would move to incite political unrest in Iran aimed at bringing down the regime. Now, we're not hearing a lot about that because, in a sense, it gives credibility to a lot of the paranoia within Iran that Israel and perhaps others are moving to try and bring about, quote, regime change. Hmm. We had just day before yesterday the assassination of one and the wounding of another Iranian nuclear scientists on their way to work with their wives in the car. Both the women were wounded as well by unknown forces. If I were in Iran and I was comparing that reality to this statement, this promise by the chief of the Mossad, I would be drawing conclusions that way as well. We're not hearing too much about that. We also saw in a June 2009 memo where Israel's defense minister, Ehud Barak, told a group of U.S. congressmen, he was talking about the so-called window of opportunity that exists to carry out a military launch against Iran. And, of course, he was saying it as a way of pressuring them, as a way of ratcheting up the demand for a military strike against Iran. But what he said was very interesting, because what he said was that this so-called window of opportunity would last from 6 to 18 months from now. This is from June of 2009, in which stopping Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons might still be viable. And he went on to say that after that 18 months, after December of 2010, after next month, he said, quote, any military solution would result in unacceptable collateral damage. So here you have the Israeli defense minister admitting that from now on, basically, any military attack on Iran is going to create unacceptable collateral damage. That's a huge admission, which, again, we're not hearing very much. So there's just a huge amount of cherry-picking going on. There's another, just one final one. Mm-hmm. June of 2009, the Israeli foreign minister, Lieberman, who's the head of the really fascist party in Israel, who's from Moldova originally, he goes to Moscow and he tells Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, that Israel is not considering a military strike on Iran, which he may have said knowing that Lavrov is very much opposed to any kind of a military strike. But nonetheless, that was a very clear, unequivocal statement by Israel's foreign minister. We are not considering a military strike. That's huge. And that, again, we're not hearing in most of the rather hysterical level coverage of the Iran stuff that we're hearing in the U.S. press.
I'm speaking with Phyllis Benes. She directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're talking about the latest WikiLeaks release. Let's talk about the revelations that the U.S. had a row with Germany over the CIA's extraordinary rendition program, and that the U.S. threatened Germany against arresting its CIA officers. How serious is this revelation, and does it reveal anything new?
I don't think this one is so new for people who were following this. This was, the U.S. was reflecting here the what they did not want to happen again from Germany. They were looking at the model of Italy, which had issued arrest warrants in absentia for six CIA agents who had been involved in a similar incident with the illegal abduction of someone from Italy who was basically kidnapped by the CIA agents and some Italian agents of some sort who were connected to them, who kidnapped someone and sent him off for interrogation. He ended up in Afghanistan and then ultimately in Guantanamo. And a similar thing had happened in Germany, and it was a German citizen who was involved. And Germany, I think at the time, was contemplating making a big public deal out of this episode, and the U.S. was basically saying, if you do, that will be the last time we ever collaborate with you on sharing intelligence data, that sort of thing. And what's so interesting about that is that it goes directly to the question of what the U.S. is claiming now as the evidence of why WikiLeaks staff should be prosecuted, because they are making it more difficult for the U.S. To collaborate with other governments because other governments will now fear that this stuff will go public.
What about, you refer to Afghanistan, there's been in the diplomatic cables also the revelation that the U.S. DEA has accused the Afghan Vice President Ahmed Zia Massoud of traveling to the United States with United Arab Emirates, rather, with $52 million in cash. The implication being that the Afghan government, our partner in the U.S. war there, is dealing drugs.
Yeah, this is also one that there's been similar allegations made before. Again, this is, I think, like the earlier documents that we saw from Iraq and from Afghanistan, the Pentagon documents, we're not seeing here very much that's sort of new and startling by itself. This is more further documentation that the involvement, in this case, of high-ranking Afghan government officials in the drug trade, in massive corruption that has so destroyed that country in the context of the U.S. war and occupation, is widely known by U.S. diplomats, by high-ranking U.S. officials, by the Obama administration at the highest levels. So it's one more. Its significance, I think, is only to the degree that it's used as a weapon to expose the hypocrisy of those who would say, well, there may be some small incidents of corruption, but overall, you know, our counterparts, the government we're supporting, are the good guys. And it's like now we have evidence in the words of U.S. diplomats themselves to say, actually, not so much. Let's be clear about who we're dealing with and who we're propping up in the context of this puppet regime in Afghanistan.
I want to go to another part of the world entirely, and that is Honduras, where there was, of course, a coup last year. And the U.S. government, it's been revealed in these diplomatic cables that have been released by WikiLeaks, the U.S. government, less than a month after the coup took place, was very clear and well aware of the basic facts of what took place. There was a cable sent to Washington with the subject, "Open and Shut the Case of the Honduran Coup," which basically said that it was an illegal and unconstitutional coup. Does that shed light, new light on the U.S. Position on the Honduras coup?
Well, it was interesting because, of course, at the time of the coup in Honduras, the U.S. was playing a very delicate game. They were not endorsing the coup, but on the other hand, they were not condemning the coup. Mm-hmm. And when they were calling for stability, they were calling for negotiation, something like that. And they were, at the time, not willing to pass judgment. They weren't willing to say, was this constitutional or not? They were saying, well, this is an internal matter, blah, blah, blah. So I think this is important, and I frankly am not aware. I don't know whether this was known already, whether there were people who follow the events in Latin America much more closely than I do who already had this documentation about the U.S. Already having a clear opinion that it was indeed a thoroughly illegal act, that it was an attempted coup, that this was not simply an internal political fight that was going on. So I think that it is quite important, again, whether it's newly proving that point or whether it's simply one more important piece of evidence proving it something that was already known, it's still important. It goes to the question of why transparency is so important. It's because statements are made, claims are made by our government in our name, with our tax money, implemented with our tax money, often based on completely fabricated realities. And what's important about these documents is less that it's telling us things that we didn't know, but that it's giving us evidence to prove that what we knew all along was indeed true and that they knew it too. So it makes the possibility of claiming this kind of, well, we didn't know what was really underway, it makes it impossible, or at least far more difficult, for U.S. government officials to make those kinds of claims. It makes accountability more possible.
Well, it certainly will do that on a global scale, but I'm wondering, finally, whether you think that biased U.S. mainstream media coverage or even media silence on the WikiLeaks document release may end up protecting U.S. government officials from domestic outrage.
Well, I think that's certainly a danger, but I think that partly because we have a vibrant and active alternative media, of which, of course, Pacifica is one of the key components. But we also are seeing that even the mainstream media is not uniformly ignoring all this stuff. A number of mainstream media outlets, the New York Times, frankly, did a fairly decent job in what they're starting to put forward in a more comprehensive way of these documents. The accessibility, I think one of the great things that The Guardian did, The Guardian of London, is that on their website they have a great set of resources, of indexes, information, for example, about which from which embassies are the largest numbers of documents coming, which was I found very interesting, the fact that Turkey is at the top of the list. There are more documents coming into the State Department headquarters from the U.S. Embassy in Turkey than from anywhere else in the world. Hmm. That tells us things. So this information is available, and even the mainstream press is not completely suppressing it. It takes some work to go through it. But I think there are a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot of people reading these documents. And because some of these things are going to be new for a lot of people, you know, the notion that the State Department is going after biometric information, credit card information, private email access codes for the Secretary General of the United Nations, I think a lot of people are going to find that pretty outrageous.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future and we'll continue to cover this story. As always, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been talking about the latest WikiLeaks release, which you can find online, the few hundred cables that have actually been released to the public so far, at cablegate.wikileaks.org. They're going to be releasing more cables at that website. A total of 251,000 cables were released to a small number of media outlets. Again, cablegate.wikileaks.org is the website. This is Uprising. After this week's People's Marketplace, we'll look at why California cities are considering water privatization and what the true cost of that is. Stay tuned.
Why can't I ever come out ahead of the bank?
Those guys are all crooks.
We want to take out a hefty loan.
Giant secret charges may apply.
Loan denied.
Oh my God!
Money
makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around.
Well, we gotta get that kind of moonwalk.
Tell me what's it gonna be?
While pundits and economists worry about Wall Street's well-being, Americans worry about losing their jobs, paying their bills, and the health of the planet. The capitalist marketplace promotes the exploitation of people and natural resources as cheap fixes. But we don't have to abandon our values to save a buck. Welcome to The People's Marketplace. I'm Martina Steiner. Someone once said, "Give and ye shall receive." Metaphysical debates aside, this is certainly true when it comes to charitable giving and your taxes. The IRS classifies most not-for-profits, like churches, homeless shelters, and your favorite public radio station, as charitable organizations, and your donations as tax-deductible. There are lots of ifs, ands, and buts when it comes to taxes. But, in short, to quantify your altruism, you'll need to itemize your federal tax return, be honest, and keep records. All cash contributions, no matter how small, should have a paper trail. If you tithe a tenner every week at church, forego the nobility of anonymity and write a check, or ask for a receipt. Start making a list of your good deed spending, and you may find you are sitting on a small jackpot of tax write-offs. For example, if you are a member of a nonprofit museum or your college's alumni association, you may be able to deduct the fee. Go to the IRS's website at irs.gov and check out the article 10 Tips for Deducting Charitable Contributions for an easy overview of the rules. Or, for lots of detail, see IRS Publications 526 and 561. Another great way to give and get a little back is to donate an old vehicle to your favorite nonprofit. This is especially handy when it comes time to retire Grandma's old Buick. Aside from the write-off, the clunker will be towed off the driveway for free. Predictably, the IRS says get a receipt from the receiving organization, and when estimating the vehicle's value, aim low. To find the fair market value of used cars, there are two trusted companies, Edmunds at www.edmunds.com and the Kelley Blue Books online home at kbb.com. If you're going to value the car at over $500, you'll need to know how much the nonprofit organization got for it at auction, because that's your price ceiling. Finally, if you donate your time and talents and, say, paint the kitchen at the homeless shelter, you can't deduct your hourly rate, but you can deduct the cost of any unreimbursed materials. And when you regularly use your car in pursuit of good works, like picking up juice and bagels for the weekly Girl Scout meeting, you can claim your miles and get about 14 cents back for each one. So, indulge your bleeding heart and fulfill your frugal fantasies. Give big before the year's end and write it off in April. Try it and stretch your dollar to meet your values. For the People's Marketplace, this is Martina Steiner.
Thanks, Martina. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Food and Water Watch released a landmark report yesterday titled Trends in Water Privatization, the Post-Recession Economy, and the Fight for Public Water in the United States. Cash-strapped localities from Coatesville, Pennsylvania to Hawthorne, California have been wooed into selling or leasing their water systems for a short-term payoff to relieve budget problems. However, Food and Water Watch uncovers the true cost of privatization, and it adds up to hundreds of dollars for the average household. In Hawthorne, the average annual water bill increased from $323 to $738 after a private company took over. In Fairbanks, Alaska, annual water bills jumped from $543 to almost $1,200. When a city privatizes its water system, it usually gets a big payment up front. However, the private company can then increase rates to turn a profit, costing residents much more in the long term than any short-term gains. Cities also lose a source of steady revenue from water bills. In San Jose, California's publicly owned water system has been a target of private interests since the 1960s. A series of economic impact studies by the city have consistently found that private ownership increases rates for residents. A 2002 review concluded that a 30-year lease with a $40 million upfront payment to San Jose would result in an average rate increase of 21% per household. Joining me on the phone this morning is Eleanor Starmer. She's the Western Region Director of Food and Water Watch. Welcome to Uprising, Eleanor.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So is this a sort of shock doctrine type of approach we're seeing here, where private companies are trying to buy up water systems in localities across the state and even the country because of the recession?
I think so. I mean, cities are in a really tough financial position right now, but they're also being aggressively courted by the private companies, and together that's a really dangerous combination. We have cities across the country with budget cuts. They're not receiving as much money from the state or from taxes as they have in the past, and they need to look someplace for revenue. So leasing or selling city services to a private company starts to look really appealing, especially when you're a politician and your time horizon only goes up until the next election. But over the long term, it's a big mistake.
Let's look at some of these examples that your report cites. I quoted the Fairbanks, Alaska, and the Hawthorne, California examples. In these cities, how exactly did it all pan out?
Well, in a number of places, the cities are still privatized, and this is one of the big trends that we identified. In our report, we reviewed 200 cases where cities have considered privatizing or have privatized their water systems and looked at some trends. And one of the new trends that's very disturbing is the trend of cities signing a 99-year lease with a private company. This is something that the private companies are aggressively requesting, and if the city signs this long lease, it's almost impossible for the city to get out of those contracts without paying a really hefty termination fee or going through a long legal battle. So it's definitely difficult. One hopeful point that we found in the report was that we found at least 17 cases where cities, just since 2008, have been able to successfully terminate contracts with private companies. And the interesting part about it is that when they got out of those long-term contracts, on average, they actually found that private operation of the water system was 21% cheaper than what they had been paying when the private company was managing it. So I think that's clear evidence that it's better to keep these public resources in public hands rather than privatizing. Unfortunately, it's just sometimes very difficult for cities to get out of those contracts.
So, I mean, it should be a no-brainer for almost any resource that the public needs to survive, whether you're talking about healthcare or you're talking about water. If there's a private entity involved whose bottom line is the most important thing, profits are going to figure into it. And so those profits are going to come from somewhere. They're going to come from the people paying for them. That should be a no-brainer, right?
You'd think that it would be. Unfortunately, our water systems are in a pretty tough position right now, too. We used to have the best drinking water and sewage system in the world, pretty much. The federal government put a ton of money into making sure that infrastructure was built and maintained in the middle of the last century. But starting under the Reagan administration, the federal government has been really getting out of the business of keeping our wastewater and drinking water systems maintained. And that's not an accident. That was, I believe, done purposefully and has opened the door for private companies to come in and say, you can't, as a city, afford to upgrade and maintain all of this infrastructure. It was in Los Angeles, the Department of Water and Power estimates that at the current rate it's able to replace pipes. It won't replace all of its pipes for 350 years. So it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. Private companies come in and say, wouldn't you prefer that we take care of that? And it looks attractive to a city that doesn't have a lot of money and that isn't getting a lot of support from the federal government. Unfortunately, once the private company comes in, their interest, as you said, is to make a profit. And I think that has a couple really negative impacts. The first is that they delay maintenance and upgrades because they're expensive, and the private company doesn't really want to pay for that either. And so service quality tends to go down. They tend to downsize staff. We tend to see more leaks and sewage spills in places where private companies are operating the systems, again, because they're not making those necessary upgrades. We also see that private operation of a water system is a disincentive to conserve, because a company that's driven by profit is going to make decisions based on profit, and they make more money when people use more water. So they're less likely to invest in conservation strategies.
Now, can't cities lease or sell their water systems and impose regulations on rate increases as well as on maintaining infrastructure and upkeep? Or if they do that, the company just won't bite?
It depends on the terms of the contract, and the contracts are all different. There are certainly different levels of privatization, so leasing or selling the service is sort of the most extreme version, but it's incredibly common given how extreme it is. Another more common agreement is a management contract where the city continues to do the rates, but the company is actually operating the system. But again, the company is the one who's in charge of maintenance and upgrades, and so what they tend to do is to hold off on making those upgrades because they don't want to pay for them, and then they use, you get to a point where there's a crisis point, and they can go to the city and say, you have to increase the rates dramatically because, this is a crisis and we need to pay for these upgrades. And so, again, it's coming out of ratepayers' pockets one way or the other.
And in cases where the companies do set the rates, then it takes power out of public hands because the public can currently, in a public water utility, go to public officials' meetings and have public hearings where they can fight or at least demonstrate against any rate increases, but they couldn't do that if a private company was in charge. Let's talk about the fact that in your report, it says that there are also nonprofit companies that are entering into deals with cities and assuming control over water systems. Is this also a dangerous trend, and is it worse than for-profit companies doing it?
I wouldn't say worse. I do think it brings up the same issues that you talk about with respect to transparency and accountability, because although a nonprofit company is in a different position in terms of needing to make a lot of money off of ratepayers, the public does still lose that direct line and accountability that it has when the system is being managed by a public entity where they can go and they can testify at a hearing and they can elect officials and they can really be involved in determining how their water system is managed. That's just not something that's possible when it's not a public entity.
Now, how can residents find out if their city is considering a lease or a sale of their water supplies? And are there any cities in California aside from San Jose, which I mentioned, where there is this real danger?
I think San Diego is one place where there is definitely a real danger. They have, as do most cities in California, a big budget shortfall, and there are several members of the city council in San Diego who have been aggressively pushing not just the privatization of their drinking water and wastewater systems, but privatization of city services overall. So this is going to be a big upcoming issue. There was an attempt by one of the city council members to get a measure on the ballot this past November that would have essentially allowed the city to outsource or privatize its city services. Luckily, that did not qualify for the ballot, but I think we can see that coming up again in the next couple years. So it's certainly a danger. In terms of people keeping vigilant about what's happening in their own community, I would encourage everyone to attend the meetings of the water utility if that's something that they can do. If people are interested in connecting with my organization, Food and Water Watch, and our website, foodandwaterwatch.org, has ways that folks can sign up for our email list, we do sort of watchdog these situations, and when a city looks like it's going to be considering privatization, we work with the community to talk about what the real costs of that would be and to help them figure out how to strategize around it.
That's foodandwaterwatch.org. Eleanor, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor Starmer is the Western Region Director of Food and Water Watch. We've been talking about the trend towards water privatization in many cities around the country, but also here in California. Again, foodandwaterwatch.org is the website. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Noam Chomsky once said, privatization does not mean you take a public institution and give it to some nice person. It means you take a public institution and give it to an unaccountable tyranny. That's Noam Chomsky. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us at facebook.com/uprisingradio. Follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. Drop us an email at mail@uprisingradio.org. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find websites that we mention on the air, as well as local events and other information. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. I didn't wanna slip from bounty.